Session number 26951.
The Lawson Reel 6. Eventually he stopped and told us what we had to do. Had to boil rice, and I think from what I can remember, it might have been eggs, I don't know. But anyway, we prepared the meal. And he had to take it with his mate, had to take it up to his men, and they were fed. But the Japanese commandant wasn't too happy with the fact that the meal hadn't turned up on time. So in true Japanese tradition, he belted the living daylights out of the cook. This is what used to happen in the Japanese army. Everybody belted everybody else below them. You know? The colonel bashed the major had to go to the captain, the lieutenant, and right down the ranks, and of course we were right at the bottom. Well, he'd already given us a good hiding, but I think he thought perhaps we'd had not enough after he'd been knocked about a bit, so he came and did us over again. We cleaned the place up, and we had a tent that we slept in, and we were in there bemoaning our sorrows and trying to keep each other's spirits up. And all of a sudden the tent flap opened, and here was the cook with gifts, as you might call them. He had some cigarettes, he had some chocolate, various other pieces of appeasement, which we accepted from him, obviously. But in a peculiar sort of a way, it was probably his way of saying sorry. But the Japanese haven't got a word for sorry. You can't translate sorry into a Japanese word. They have never said sorry about the conditions, about the way they treat us, and that is one of the things which I can probably comment on later. But that was, I think, that was his way of saying sorry. I can't remember how long I was in this Japanese cookhouse, but we did move with these engineers into another camp. Further up the railway.
What was your routine in this particular camp, the cookhouse? What were you doing during the day?
Cook.
Just cooking.
Yeah.
You weren't working.
You had to chop the wood for the fires, and prepare the food and cook it and wash up, clean up, and all this sort of thing. You know, but normally what happens in the cookhouse? But we did. I did go into an. But they did take us into another camp, which was in a rather beautiful place. It was in a valley, and the vegetation, you know, the valley was very, very heavily wooded, and there was a lot of tropical flowers about. It was a rather pretty place. And while we were there, this is the one thing I can remember about this place. While we were there, the cook came one day, and he brought a cow into the cookhouse, live, on the hoof. And he gave us to understand that he wanted us to kill the cow and butcher it. Well, I mean, one lad knew a bit about butchering, but had no idea how to kill a cow. And this was rather, when I look back on it, it was rather cruel, but what else could you do? We tied a rope round the cow's neck and pulled its head down round a tree to it, and just hit it on the head with a hammer. Of course, I hit it a few times, poor thing. Never mind it, we killed it, and we cut it apart as best we could. And he was quite happy with what we did. You know, the steaks were there, and the meat was there for these, for the Japanese. But they wouldn't touch the offal. You know, heart, kidneys, liver, wouldn't look at it. So we did. The four of us made up some marvellous stew of liver and kidneys, and we fried it and we did all sorts of things. Managed to keep it cool, you know, but it lasted perhaps only a couple of days, but never mind, I remember that incident. And another, at the same time, round about this time, they allowed me to go to the nearest prison of war, nearest camp where the prisoners of war was working. And the railway was built up to where they were. And fortunately, I got a lift on the railway, one of these pump-handled things, and went to this camp and saw some of our lads. And in that camp, there was an officer who was in charge. We used to get a little bit of pay from time to time. I don't know where it came from. But I got a little bit of money for the four of us, and I went to see one or two of the lads in hospital. And it was good seeing them again. Their spirits weren't dampened. They were still moaning on about everything, obviously. But they weren't. Their spirits were pretty high, compared to the life that they were living. I went back and back to this cook house and passed on little bits of messages that I'd gleaned from the lads. Then after that, I'm afraid I'm a bit of a blank. I can't remember how or why I got back down to Chiang Kai. I just can't. I don't know why this would happen, but there are certain periods where mine's just a blank. But went down to Chiang Kai because that was the place where the railway was finished then.
How long had you been in captivity by this time?
By this time, I was 3.5 years all told, probably about 2 years, 2.5 years, something like that. Again, dates and times are very difficult to put a time on. Chiang Kai was a base camp, really, as well as being a hospital camp. And there was very little work there. There was no work. What was happening was that this base camp was then used as a source of sending people back up the railway to maintain it. Maintain the railway as sleepers coming apart and this sort of thing. And there was a hospital camp, of course. Now, the thing I remember about that was the hospitals. I walked through some of the huts to try and find some of the lads of our own regiment, because we were all mixed up by then. I've never experienced anything like that in my life. Lads lying on the bamboo slats with legs half eaten away with ulcers, and the stench was absolutely unbearable. But my stay there, as I say, I can't remember too much about it. But before I go on, if I can just come back to another camp I was in. Again, some of these camps, they don't. See, I was in so many that you don't remember the names. But in this particular camp, I met up with, it must have been after I left Dirk Ward, must have been, because he wasn't with me. But I met up with a chap called Edrich. Edrich will come to mind as a cricketer. Now, with Bill Edrich's brother, just let me think. It was Jeff Edrich, Bill Edrich's brother. And I don't know, we just seemed to strike up a friendship, and we used to talk a lot of cricket, you know, and pull each other's legs, pretend to be Australians and English. But he became a very good friend. So much so that I met him after the war when he was playing for Lancashire. But in that camp, I had to go into the sick hut, and I wasn't too well. And to give some idea of how cheap life was, I was lying literally shoulder to shoulder between two other chaps. And it was, well, it did turn out to be 5 minutes to 12 at night. And I'll tell you how I know that in a minute. I was lying at this bloke on my right. It was pretty obvious to me that he was dead or dying. And I shouted of the orderly, one of our lads, and the medical orderly, he came down. And he had to straddle his body. And he looked at him and he said, I think the poor bugger's dead. He took a mirror out of his pocket and put it over the man's mouth. And he looked at him and he said, my God, he said, he's cost me 20 fags. I said, what do you mean? He said, he's dead. He said, I bet my mate that he would live till 12 o'clock and so 5 to 12. You can see how that instance gives an example of how you accepted death. To me now, going to funerals troubles me. Because I've seen so much death, it doesn't mean anything. You know, when I go to funerals, I go not for the person who's dead, but for the family or the friends. And I don't get emotional about death anymore, unless it's somebody really close. When I go to funerals now, and it has happened because I'm a member of the Far East Prisoner War Club, and our lads die and I go to the funerals. But I had, while I was chairman of this club some years ago, there were four deaths in a year. After the second one, I said to my wife, I said, look, I can't go there anymore. Because I felt that I was in the church just looking around, and